Hello, and welcome back, everyone, to the Realist Foreign Policy Podcast Part 2. My name is Mark Jarrett, and I'm a research analyst here at the NATO Association of Canada. And I'm joined once again by my work colleague, Alexi Amini, Program Editor of the Canadian Armed Forces here at the NATO Association of Canada. So a recap on the last part, we essentially talked about the theories of realism and what realism was about and using the Gulf War from the early 90s and the Iraq invasion of 2003 as examples. Today we will be talking about a realist foreign policy in the Canadian context. Now, Canada has historically strived to be a peacekeeping nation and following a more idealist foreign policy, trying to spread their values on other countries, viewing them to be as universal. However, this has not been very successful, and there are a number of downfalls. One downfall being peacekeeping missions are quite expensive and exhaust a lot of resources. If belligerents in a particular region hate each other enough, they're going to fight regardless, like in the Six-Day War, where Israel attacked Egypt in the presence of peacekeepers, and of course, let's not forget Rwanda. One example where it was successful was Cyprus, because Turkey and Greece weren't able to project their power over the Mediterranean Sea, because there were more costs than benefits, and they were both NATO members in the context of the Cold War. Canada, I believe, has recognized that they need to change from being a peacekeeping country. This is evident in our current government's actions by shuffling around six members in the cabinet after Trump got elected as president in the States, most notably replacing Stéphane Dion, who was a strong advocate for peacekeeping missions, with Chrystia Freeland, someone who believed Canada should take a more stern combat role. The other move done by the Liberals that shows Canada to be moving away from the peacekeeping missions is putting the Mali mission that was supposed to happen this year on the back burner. Another telltale sign that shows Canada's leaning away from peacekeeping is using the word peacemaking instead, insinuating that a combat role is more likely to take place in the near future. And now I'm going to pass the mic off to Alexi to discuss what shape a Canadian realist foreign policy in the Middle East would look like.
Thank you, Mark. Well, first of all, it is important to bear in mind that a potential Canadian realist foreign policy in the Middle East will be contingent on the U.S. shift from a direct intervention strategy to a regional balance of power strategy, which is a concept popularized by John Mersheimer in his book, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Concretely, it is a hands-off approach where the U.S. would expect the local powers to do more for their national security, and we should be more active in checking each other. And moreover, the U.S. isn't supporting one specific power. It is, in the Middle East, it is as uncomfortable with Iranian regional hegemony as it would be with Saudi regional hegemony, Turkish or Israeli, for that matter. The U.S., as a result, will try to cultivate relationships with all powers, play one power versus the other. This would entail that for some countries, the relationship will be mostly limited to trade, while for others, the relationships will be more encompassing, like defense partnerships, including military assistance, arms sales, training. For example, following the Iranian nuclear deal, which is the building block of this emerging U.S. balance of power strategy, the U.S. is right now cooperating with Iran against ISIS in Iraq, especially with the popular mobilization forces that are Shia militias. In addition, the U.S. is trying to resume its trade relationship with Iran following the Islamic Revolution in 1979, where the $16.6 billion deal between Boeing and Iran Air for 80 passenger jets testifies to. And in parallel to that, the U.S. is balancing its relationship with Iran with status quo Sunni powers, as well as Israel. For example, Washington is supporting the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen against the pro-Iranian Houthis. In addition, following the Iranian nuclear deal, the U.S. has sold billions of dollars worth of equipment, military equipment, to Israel and the GCC countries as an additional reassurance measure in the framework of this balance of power strategy. And as a result, those local powers, and more specifically the status quo powers, which are Israel, the GCC powers, and Turkey, they are looking to diversify their partnerships with extra-regional powers that, like the U.S., wouldn't want to put all their weight behind one specific country and facilitate their regional hegemonic bid, but cultivate relationships with all the players in the region, play one power against the other, like with some countries' own relationship is limited to trade, and others more encompassing like defense partnerships. That could be the case of Canada, that might have a few ace up its sleeves in the context of the diversification effort of status quo powers in the region. For example, Canada has right now an operational support base in the Middle East, in Kuwait, since 2011, has been renewed in 2014. It is not a permanent military presence per se, but a staging area which quickens the deployment of Canadian combat forces in the region if a crisis arises. And that's something that not many middle powers have. In addition to this operational support hub, the Canadians can actually increase their presence in the region by arms sales and training. Arms sales that, let's remember that in 2014, Canada struck a deal with Saudi Arabia, a $15 billion deal for LAV-3 infantry fighting vehicles. This success is due to the fact that the Canadian defense industry is specialized in certain sectors, like ground vehicle integration and armor. And in the years to come, that probably won't be the only contract that Canada might win. And even if it's not a Canadian design that wins a competition among the status quo powers, Canada will still win because lots of Canadian components can be found in foreign designs. Let's not forget that the Canadian defense industry is pretty good at producing high components like infrared sensors and electro-optical sensors that can be integrated into foreign designs, as well as sonar systems and propulsion systems that could be integrated into foreign naval design. In addition, arms sales, Canada can also increase the training of between Canadian forces and the forces of status quo powers. For example, Canada can actually invite the Royal Saudi Air Force or the Emirati Air Force more frequently at Cold Lake Air Force Base for Exercise Maple Flag. Let's not forget that Cold Lake Air Force Base has one of the vastest airspaces in the world to conduct realistic military trainings. And in parallel to military partnerships with the status quo powers, either GCC, Turkey, or Israel, Canada is balancing its relationship with Iran. And this is mostly trade, because Canada can't sell weapons to Iran. That would create quite a backlash, plus there's an embargo going on. So it would mostly be like civilian products. And right now, Bombardier is really interested in selling to Iran Air some passenger jets for like domestic flights. So as we can see, Canada has a few aces up its sleeve if it goes for a realist foreign policy in the Middle East, in light of a U.S. shift from a direct intervention strategy to a balance of power strategy.
Thank you, Alexei, for explaining how a middle power like Canada, using their finite resources and idealistic foreign policy that has produced mixed results, perhaps Canada could better employ its limited resources in the framework of a realist foreign policy, which would be more successful, increasing Canada's footprint in the world, and particularly the Middle East. This concludes the Realist Foreign Policy Podcast Part 2. Thank you for listening.